Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Sioux City Council this week agreed to find out if the public can vote on a possible fireworks ban. All five council members heard a glut of post-Independence Day fireworks complaints over the past week or so and said they wanted to limit the time allowed for discharging fireworks to 2 or 3 days. Citizens talked mostly about their negative experiences. David Johnston of Morningside told the council he was surrounded by neighbors who were setting off fireworks at all hours.
And it was like a war zone. And my comment is this, again, I've been in the same place for 30 years. You know, I understand the Iowa legislature passed this. It's a way of making more money for the state and then put the problem on you as the city. But like I said, I've never seen it that way before. And I believe we, some citizens have rights to go on with a normal life. And I'm not going to stay where I'm at. If this continues next year, I'm going to be moving.
Tony Siabong is also from Morningside. She brought a large bag of used fireworks that ended up on her roof.
You would think I would have had a blast in the 4th of July. However, none of these are mine. These were everything that landed on my yard, my front porch, my tree, and my roof from my neighbors. And I understand the noise pollution. I get that. And we've had animals. I understand that too, and for veterans. But also at the same time, we sat fearfully that entire night, and that was the only night our neighbors had them, with them landing on our house. And I have to say, I was glad that we had a roof inspector out to look at our hail damage, because he swept up all the leaves, and if that hadn't happened or the wind hadn't blown, I think we would have had a fire at our house. And I honestly don't like living in that fear.
But not everyone that spoke up at the council meeting wanted to ban fireworks in Sioux City. Leo Hammond of the West Side said he wasn't trying to stop fireworks use, but he would like to see some reasonable rules for their use in the city.
Every 4th of July, guys, we've had a lot of fireworks in the neighborhood, in the area. And we aren't the only ones. I can hear them off in the distance, too. So my neighborhood ain't the only one, and I realize that, too. But at the same time, I do want fireworks here. I do. One of the reasons why we're having so much in the neighborhoods is we've outlawed using them in the parks. We put a 10 o'clock ban on fireworks where it don't get dark until after 9 o'clock on 4th of July. So what are they going to do, use their fireworks for 45 minutes? I don't think that's going to cut it, do you?
And resident Brent Watchhorn spoke out in favor of personal freedoms and called for a public vote on a fireworks ban.
The curfew was ridiculous. Like he said, there was only 45 minutes of nighttime to light off night fireworks. That's ridiculous. And the majority of people in this city seem to be, by the sound of it at least, that they want this to continue. And I believe the restrictions are too harsh myself, but I can understand where a few things could be leaned on. My proposal would be, if you're actually going to try and ban anything or change the ordinance in any way, why not open it up to a citywide vote? Because the fact is, I'm sorry, we don't get a full population opinion here. I believe the city should be able to vote on what they believe should be done, whether it be a ban or loosening the regulations.
Watchhorn repeated his idea for a public vote on a fireworks ban as Council Member Rhonda Capron and Mayor Bob Scott seemed receptive to it.
You don't maybe are city representatives, but you don't represent the entire city. You need to open it up to a vote for any change.
Well, then I don't think, can we do that?
I'd gladly do that.
Yeah, I would too. I'll tell you what, you'd be real surprised how it would turn out.
The city attorney said she would need to find out how such a referendum would work. Iowa's new law legalizing the sale and discharge of fireworks allows a city council to prohibit or limit the use of consumer fireworks, display fireworks, or novelties. The city's original ordinance allowed the discharge of fireworks from June 25th through July 4th. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. A few weeks ago, the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors passed a motion that would allow firearms in county buildings. Board Chairman Matthew Ung said he felt it was important to make the decision before July 1st, when a new state law allowing guns on public property, such as county buildings, became law. However, some in the county said the measure was going against a recent ruling by Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady, who said that guns would not be allowed in courtrooms across the state of Iowa. So, who has the last word on this issue? We asked attorney Angie Schneiderman of Sioux City how she thought this issue might play out in the legal arena.
Well, and the complicated answer is both the legislature and the Supreme Court have authority on the issue. At this point, the legislature, to my knowledge, hasn't you know, filed any bills or sent anything to the governor for signature that would address that. But the Supreme Court is relying on a provision within the Constitution that allows them certain governance rights as it relates to lower judicial courts.
So basically, if it were to come down to it, and then if the legislature, say, would come back and say, okay, we're going to pass a law that they try to supersede what the court has done, can they do that?
Well, the legislature has power to make laws to the extent that are within the bounds of our state and federal constitutions. And so to the extent that they're perhaps exceeding or infringing, shall I say, what the judicial branch has in terms of powers under the state constitution, it could very well be that if the proper case comes up before our Iowa Supreme Court, that they would find that that particular type of law may be unconstitutional.
Could a challenge to what the Supreme Court has done go to a higher court?
There's certainly the potential of that. the real trick, though, is writing a petition for cert that the Supreme Court would actually take up. And I don't have the stats on that in front of me, but the Supreme Court gets probably thousands of those applications every year, and they're very picky about what they would pick up in terms of a case for review.
Yeah, and this is a case, I would assume they would have to think it was something that was an important issue, right, that they would decide on.
Right, and typically when you see the Supreme Court of the United States pick up an issue, it's usually a conflict of rulings on federal law between federal courts, different circuits, or differences that you see between states, where perhaps the federal constitution might have some sort of decision-making impact on those differences in law.
You know, what this strikes me as is, okay, you say the law says you can have firearms in county buildings, but maybe they could come into the courthouse with a firearm, but they can't go into the courtroom with a firearm.
Right, and that is a very real risk. You know, it's interesting. I looked at our statutes and our constitution earlier today to think about that a little bit. And the counties, by law, by the direction of the legislature, have an obligation to provide courtroom space for our courts to operate in each county. But then again, you've got the constitutional provision that does give the Supreme Court the jurisdiction to, you know, make certain rules and policies regarding those courtrooms. And so is there a potential that you can have some different rules that apply in different spaces within a courthouse? I think so.
That was attorney Angie Schneiderman of the Sioux City law firm of Moore, Heffernan, Moeller, Johnson and Meese. She was talking about some of the possible outcomes of the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors' decision to allow firearms in county buildings. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. America's hospitals are in transition. They're suffering from a lack of reimbursement from Medicaid and Medicare, and rural hospitals have yet more issues to deal with. Nearly 675 rural hospitals could be closed in the coming years and leave nearly 12 million Americans at risk of losing access to their closest emergency room. This comes as nearly 80% of rural counties are facing primary health professional shortages, and 9% of those counties have no doctor at all. Under the terms of the Republican House and Senate bills, small rural hospitals could end up worse off than they are now. Iowa Democratic Representative Dave Lobsack has co-sponsored a bipartisan bill this week that would address critical health care shortages in rural communities to help alleviate some of that problem. The Save Rural Hospitals Act provides a permanent extension of the rural ambulance and super rural ambulance payments. It would also provide an innovation model for rural hospitals that continue to struggle. Maggie Elwini is with the National Rural Health Association, and she says she's in favor of the Save Rural Hospitals Act. She provides some backstory about the problems with rural hospital funding that she says goes way back to the 1980s.
So Congress back in the 80s changed the way hospitals were paid to a prospective payment system. It used to be a fee-for-service system, meaning that you did one service and you received a fee. Congress tried to control spending and sort of they did more of a group payment, more of a based on a quantity system, sort of a Costco system, which was tested in these large urban facilities, and it seemed like an okay payment system for them. Unfortunately, it wasn't tested properly in rural America, and it was absolutely devastating. We saw hundreds of rural hospitals close across the country in the 80s and early 90s.
So what did Congress, and specifically Senator Chuck Grassley, do to try and remedy this situation?
So they created these unique payments for rural hospitals. So these hospitals could keep their doors open, and so rural Americans would have access to the emergency room, to their local hospital. So the biggest of these categories of different rural hospitals they created was the critical access hospital. That's the smallest of all hospitals. Iowa has a large number of them. They also have a lot of other types of a little bit larger, but something called a Medicare-dependent hospital. The Medicare-dependent hospital is based on that PPS system, but it's also, if you're a rural hospital, if you're a small hospital, and you also treat a high number of elderly patients, Medicare patients, you get a little additional reimbursement payment just to help you through Medicare, just to help you keep your doors open. So the other payment system they developed was this critical access hospital system. Those are for the tiny guys, and Iowa, as I said, has its fair share. You've got to have 25 beds or fewer. You generally have to be 35 miles or more from another hospital, and you obviously definitely have to be rural. You can only do certain procedures at this facility. Basically, you are the hospital for a rural community. You have an emergency room, so if there is a heart attack or something like that, you treat that patient, and then the patient, if they need to be transferred to a larger facility, does. So there's really strict rules on being a critical access hospital. But again, because you're that way, Congress said you get a slightly enhanced Medicare reimbursement rate so you can keep your doors open.
You say that Congress has been slowly whittling away at those special payments for rural hospitals, but the Affordable Care Act has been an even bigger factor in causing these hospitals to close.
So the whole goal of the ACA was to insure people, right? And they were going to do that in one of two ways. First, they were going to have half of those people, of those 37 million people, were going to be insured through Medicaid expansion. Well, no one predicted that the Supreme Court would do what they did and said, hey, states, you don't have to expand Medicaid if you don't want to. That left a large swath of individuals in rural America without insurance coverage who could have been insured. They don't receive subsidies through the Affordable Care Act. So there's a lot of them are the working poor. Obviously, they still get sick. They still show up in the emergency room. But because they don't have health insurance, it's often that rural hospital that ends up, you know, kind of subsidizing their care. The other way that that the ACA was supposed to work was to have people buy insurance, right? That people were going to get affordable insurance. If they couldn't afford their insurance, Congress was going to give them a federal subsidy or a tax credit.
So how has this been working out here in rural America?
Unfortunately, the way it's worked in rural America is that the way prices were supposed to stay low is there was supposed to be market penetration, planned competition. Insurance companies were going to fight for the business and basically keep their prices lower through, you know, just a competitive process. That has completely failed in rural America. What we have seen is that these big insurance companies are pulling out of rural market after rural market. In fact, 70% of the counties that these big insurers have pulled out of have been rural counties, leaving so many rural Americans with no choice. Maybe there's just one plan in the area. And it looks like in 2018, we're going to have places, and I know Iowa was very concerned that they weren't going to have a plan at all in 2018. Our frustration is that we see these big insurance companies who are making record profits the last couple of years, in other areas of their business, and there's nothing wrong with making record profits, but our frustration is that they just are refusing to go into some of these rural markets because they don't think it's going to be profitable enough for them.
Well, I know that the ACA, one of its goals was also to help hospitals, and rural hospitals included, have less bad debt so they'd be more solvent.
Before the ACA, Congress and the administration, the Obama administration said, hey, hospitals, we're going to give you a lot more paying customers. You're not going to have any uninsured. You're not going to have bad debt because people are either going to be covered by Medicaid or they're going to have to buy insurance. So you shouldn't have as much bad debt. Well, that didn't happen in rural America. They cut the amount of bad debt that a hospital could write off, just like you would write off maybe bad debt on your taxes. The federal government used to help hospitals who had a lot of people who couldn't pay for their bill. So they cut that very, very dramatically. But what happened since the ACA has been signed into law, the bad debt for rural hospitals has gone up by 50%. And the hospitals are basically subsidizing a lot of care, even though folks may have insurance.
So why is this concentrated in rural hospitals?
So in rural America, people who can't afford a plan think they can only afford probably the bronze plan. They view that in most areas as the most affordable. The deductible there is ridiculously high for many of those bronze plans. Maybe $7,500. So if you were to suffer a heart attack in a rural area, what do? You go to that local emergency room. Hopefully they save your life. They stabilize you. Because they're a rural hospital, they can only hold you there for so long. They then have to transfer you to your follow-up care to a larger urban facility. What happens? Well, you couldn't afford your $7,500 deductible. You can't pay that rural hospital bill. But what happens when you transfer to that bigger facility? Ooh, your insurance finally kicks in. You met your deductible with that small hospital, the rural hospital, but and then your insurance kicks in when you're transferred. So what we see is, and this is totally an unintended consequence, and I know the argument's kind of nuanced, but we really see that this bad debt cut is really just like a laser beam focused on these rural hospitals. And again, bad debt has gone up 50%. We're getting these small rural hospitals who already operate on the narrowest of financial margins all of a sudden are having to absorb all this bad debt, and they just can't do it. And that's what we see is really triggering a lot of the hospital closure crisis. So it's not the intent of the ACA to really cause rural hospitals to close, but the way it's been, way it's unfolded and the way it's been implemented is really causing a huge problem for rural hospitals.
It seems like rural communities really suffer and start to deteriorate when these hospitals leave.
When these rural hospitals close, they just don't return. And almost always the doctor is hospital-based. So when the hospital closes, the doctors leave town, the nurses leave town, the pharmacists leave town. What we're seeing are these medical deserts forming across the country. There was a hospital that closed in southern Nevada, the next nearest hospital, 120 miles away. So it's really tough. And with that, you got to factor in that, you know, I work in Washington, D.C. There's 16 metropolitan hospitals between D.C. and Northern Virginia. One of those closes, what's going to happen to the D.C. economy? Probably not much. There'll be another hospital that moves in or one of the other 15 hospitals that will absorb the patients and add more jobs. But what happens when these hospitals close in rural America? Just instantly, 20% of the rural economy is gone. What family is going to want to stay in a rural area, relocate to a rural area? What retirees, if they don't have access to care, are going to want to stay there? You know, there's studies that show that housing values are actually declining when these hospitals close. So it's absolutely detrimental to these rural communities. That's what we're trying to tell Congress, we're trying to tell Capitol Hill, is that, you know, there's this huge unintended consequence, and the way the ACA is unfolding, and that both the House and the Senate had the opportunity to fix these problems, but what did they do?
You say the House and Senate both have an opportunity to fix these problems, but you don't seem to think that either of these options has much of a chance of making a difference.
They have the House bill, and the Senate recently introduced Senate bill, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, which sounds like, from all intelligence, isn't going to be the bill that they try to get a vote on because they simply don't have the votes. The goal is to have some compromise, some way to bring in the moderates and the conservatives and get a vote by next week. The House would then probably just accept the Senate version of the bill and send it to the president's desk. So things could happen very quickly if there's an agreement in the Senate. So it all kind of hinges on some of these meetings that they're having within the next couple of days. I think they're in a meeting right now as we speak.
What do you think about this Save Our Rural Hospitals bill?
Thank you for asking about that. It has been introduced by Representative Lobsack of Iowa and Representative Graves from Missouri, and we couldn't be happier about it. This important bill paints the picture of why rural hospitals are so struggling right now. And it paints that comprehensive picture of just how much rural hospitals have been cut. I talked about the damage that the well-intended Affordable Care Act was doing to rural hospitals, the way the bill has been implemented. But that's just some of the cuts. You know, sequestration cuts have hit rural hospitals hard. There's been a whole series of other cuts that just have hit rural hospitals. The great thing about the Save Rural Hospital Act, it doesn't increase reimbursement rates to rural hospitals by a dime. It simply says, Congress, you crafted these special rural health care payments to keep hospital doors in rural America open. You seem to have forgotten that. What this bill does is simply stop those cuts. We think that will significantly level the playing field and help a lot of hospitals stay open. But it also provides a path forward. We know that some are just too far in debt and they just can't make it. It provides a path forward to help patients in that community have access to an emergency room. What it does is it creates a new type of hospital. I talked to you way back about 1997, when really the last of these hospital models was created. 1997 was a long time ago. Medicine has changed significantly since then. We're excited about a new model that really reflects patient care and really the lack, the decreased amount of time that people stay in hospitals. So this model is called a community outpatient hospital. And what it does is it has that 24/7 ER, which is so critical to rural communities. But then what it has is maybe a clinic or whatever type of outpatient care they think is needed. So it will really help the community maintain access to their physician and treat broken bones or maintain their diabetes treatment, things like that, but it wouldn't have any actual inpatient beds. So we think this kind of hybrid makes sense for maybe some smaller communities who just don't have the patient volume to support a full-scale hospital. We think it makes sense for some communities throughout the area and are just thrilled that the bill has been introduced and could offer this kind of lifeline to so many of these hospitals who struggle.
That was Maggie Elawani with the National Rural Health Association. She talked about the need to create innovative solutions for rural hospitals as the House and Senate debate a new health care insurance plan. You are listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Robert Kennedy was killed nearly 50 years ago by an assassin while on the campaign trail. Kennedy left a legacy of progressive action on humanitarian issues like poverty and ending racism. A new book delves into Kennedy's early years when he worked for Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy on his subcommittee to root out communists in the government back in the 1950s. At the time, Kennedy was often called ruthless and hard. Author and longtime journalist Larry Tye takes a balanced look at Robert Kennedy in his book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Tye says he wanted to write the book because Kennedy is such a complex figure, he deserves a closer look.
Bobby Kennedy is an intriguing figure, and we do know him as a liberal icon, and that earlier chapter of his relationship with McCarthy was A, counterintuitive, and most people didn't know about it, B, the people who did know about it write it off, including his children, as a footnote or an asterisk in terms of his career, when in fact it was something much more significant. And he stayed there for 7.5 months. It was his first real job. And for the rest of his life and McCarthy's life, he defended McCarthy in a way that was surprising, and so I thought it said something partly about what an extraordinarily loyal guy Bobby Kennedy was. On the other hand, being loyal to witch hunting Joe McCarthy seemed like misplaced loyalty. So I thought it was, and I confirmed having had so many people tell me that this was a chapter that didn't matter in his life, I trusted the only person that is alive that I felt like I could ask and get a real sense of that, and that is Bobby's widow, Ethel, who said that McCarthy, the friendship with McCarthy was really important, the working relationship and what he learned from him was really significant, and it wasn't something to be written off.
Well, and she said that McCarthy wasn't like people thought, that he was a lot of fun to be around, and she enjoyed him.
She did, and I'm actually now working on a biography of Joe McCarthy. And so what she said is consistent with a lot of people who knew McCarthy, which is that the McCarthy that was running the committee and was on public display was not the McCarthy that they knew. And that was part of what intrigued me to want to write a biography of McCarthy, to understand how the public and private personalities differed. And that was suggested by Bobby Kennedy and his, the fact that he found McCarthy so appealing. And the and I don't think it excuses anything that McCarthy was or did, but it says that he's a more complicated character than the caricature we sort of are left with, just the same way that Bobby Kennedy is a more complicated character than the liberal icon that I thought he was.
Well, in fact, his father believed that he and his son Bobby had a lot in common. They were both fierce. They both really took after, a project, and when they liked someone, they liked them. When they didn't like someone, they just went after him with everything they had.
They did. So Joe Kennedy was quoted as saying, and whether he did or not,
I think he believed it, as saying that Bobby knew how to hate like he did, like Joe Kennedy did. And I think that the Joe Kennedy was fierce in everything he did in business and in politics and in raising his kids, and so was Bobby. And it wasn't accidental that Bobby was the one that Joe tapped to take over the leadership of the Klan as Joe was aging and knew at some point he'd be out of the picture, and was out of the picture sooner than anybody had planned given his stroke. But the but Bobby was the executor of his estate and the one that he saw as sort of keeping the family together, and he trusted him more to do that than he did John Kennedy or any of his other kids.
Well, Bobby also, he was on a subcommittee, went after organized labor, Jimmy Hoffa, the rackets, and then at some point, and then he helped his brother win his presidential campaign. He also worked on the Senate campaign. At what point did the Bobby Kennedy we all sort of know and many people love to this day start to appear?
So there were pieces of him that appeared early on, and he was, even when he was working for McCarthy and was the guy that the press and others were characterizing as ruthless, there were parts of the more tender side that started to appear. But I think the real Bobby Kennedy and the Bobby Kennedy that we were left with in 1968 really started to show up most of all after his brother's assassination in November of 1963. That was the epiphany moment for him. That was the point at which he had to reevaluate his whole life. And when he actually started, at the suggestion of his sister-in-law, Jackie Kennedy, reading Greek tragedies, and he saw, the same way Jackie had, the whole Kennedy experience as a bit of a Greek tragedy, that a family with great hubris, seemingly at the top of the world, suddenly loses it all and has to decide, what really matters. And Bobby had contemplated, I think, at that point, actually withdrawing from public life and instead decided to reengage in a way that was much more empathetic, much more sensitive to the underdog and to loss. And that's when, if there was one single moment when the dial started turning from tough to tender for him, it was then.
When I was living in Indianapolis, they had the anniversary of the time when Bobby Kennedy came through on the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, and they had huge crowds. And people were saying there's going to be a riot, it's going to be terrible. And he went out there and he basically calmed the whole crowd. It was like he became this amazing leader.
He did. So he gave a lot of memorable speeches in his life. None was under circumstances like what happened that night in Indianapolis. He had been campaigning. Indiana was his first contested primary in 68. He was out all day campaigning. He flew in on the Caroline, the family plane, that afternoon. was greeted at the airport by the then young mayor who went on to become an old senator named Richard Lugar. Lugar told him that Martin Luther King had just been shot and killed in Memphis and that Bobby shouldn't go into the ghetto in Indianapolis to give the speech he had planned to give that night. He shouldn't go there because he might not come out alive, and more importantly, he shouldn't go there because he might cause a riot. And Bobby listened to the advice, proceeded to ignore it, went into the ghetto, jumped up on the back of a flatbed pickup truck, took the notes that his young aides had given him and crumpled them up and threw them away, and for the next 5 minutes gave what may have been the most impassioned and the most effective speech that any white politician had ever delivered in Black America. And what happened that night was extraordinary, because in just about every city in America that had a substantial African-American population, there were riots that night. Parts of Washington were burned down, and one of the only cities that didn't riot was Indianapolis, and that was because Bobby Kennedy had appealed for people to come together, and he basically said in a way that probably nobody would have ever had the credibility in saying that he understood what it was like to lose somebody that close to him. It was the first time in 5 years that he had talked in public about the assassination of his brother, and he said the instinct was to want to strike out, that what people in fact had to do was come together. And he went into that community that night to embrace Black America for the loss of Martin Luther King, and instead the Black community of Indianapolis ended up embracing him for the loss of his brother, and it was a bit of magic.
I know you have to go, but I just had one more question.
Sure.
If he hadn't have been killed in California during the campaign, the presidential campaign, what do you think would have happened with him? What do you think he might have achieved or tried to achieve?
So I think three things would have happened. One is that he would have, no question in my mind, been the Democratic nominee, that the morning after his great victory in California, he was due to meet with Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago, who was going to endorse him. And I think that the endorsement from the most powerful establishment politician in the country would have set off a wave of comparable endorsements. I think he would have been, the ticket would have been Kennedy-Humphrey. Democrats, like Republicans, united their top two vote-getters. Generally, no matter how much they liked or disliked one another, came together, and Humphrey and Bobby actually liked one another. I think they would have easily beat Richard Nixon, because the one politician in America who understood Nixon's vulnerabilities better than anybody was Bobby, who 8 years before had helped his brother beat Nixon. And I think what would have happened is 5 minutes after he was elected, because he was incredibly passionate and incredibly impatient, he would have tried to get a strong civil rights bill. He would have pushed ahead with his plans to try to end poverty in America. And he would, most importantly of all, have gotten us out of Vietnam. We wouldn't have had to wait the years that we did under Richard Nixon. So we would have had, I think, a very different country that would have meant that 50 years later we wouldn't be revisiting the same causes of racial tension and overseas engagements that we are now.
That was Larry Tai, the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. When Robert Kennedy was running for president of the United States, he was often known as a progressive or a liberal. At the same time, a relatively new political party was gaining prominence in American society, and it seems to have stemmed from a rather surprising source. The forces behind the Libertarian Party include economists, theorists, and writers. One of them was Rose Wilder Lane, the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the author of the Little House series of books for children. In fact, Rose and her mother agreed with many of the ideals of the Libertarian Party. Rose was instrumental in infusing the Little House books with those ideals. Christine Woodside is the author of the book Libertarians on the Prairie, Laura Ingalls Wilder and the Making of the Little House Books. Woodside says Lane became interested in libertarianism in large part because she really hated communism.
Rose Leather Lane became a fervent anti-communist in the 1920s, which was right after World War One, and everybody was very nervous about the communist threat because of the revolution in Russia. That's how it started for her. She got involved in thinking about economics, and she became very vocal about we must be true to the Constitution. But you hear a lot about that today in politics, and that it started back then. So she then started writing about this stuff, and she became so nutty that the Saturday Evening Post stopped publishing her fiction because they told her it was propaganda. She thought that you needed to let the free market do its thing. And if you didn't, then you weren't letting people be their true selves, and then we were squashing them. And these are all very appealing ideas, by the way, you know, in a pure sense, very pure. So that was how it started for her, is she started communicating with corporate people and economists and writers and other political activists sort of like her. They would meet, they would write and exchange ideas. And that was all going on for Rose. It began to pick up in the mid-1930s while she was still working on the Little House books with Laura, her mother. And then she really kind of went completely off the scale with it in the 1940s.
I would think that the fact that the Little House books were largely written during the Great Depression might have played into this. She wrote a book about Herbert Hoover. She was a big supporter of Hoover and his, you know, ideas about self-reliance.
Yes, she was. She and Hoover corresponded until she was rather old, I mean, until the end of their lives, sort of. That's right. She also hated Roosevelt, and so did Laura, and they used to talk about that to each other. So they thought a lot about the meaning of the pioneer story through that lens of we wish the government would get out of our lives, which is the way many farmers felt during the 1930s when suddenly there were limits on crops you could grow, and there were government programs, and there were taxes, and you know, the New Deal. They were very angry, really angry about that. And it did show in their writing.
Now, in the books, I do remember specific parts. One that really came to me as I was thinking about this was from Little House on the Prairie, and they're building the house, and he had to borrow nails from the neighbor. And there's a big discussion about, oh, how are we going to pay him back for the nails? We don't want to be beholden to anyone for anything.
That's right.
They're nails.
Yeah, and you know, Little House on the Prairie, the book about them going to the Indian lands, was of all the Little House books, it was the one they had to make up pretty much out of whole cloth because Laura herself had been so young when she went there. She and Rose did a bunch of research and they made it as historically accurate as they could, but these memories, she didn't remember her parents having that conversation. They just had to, you know, make a guess that they talked that way.
And in your book, you really delve into this and you go into a few instances that really show this, where in Farmer Boy, his Almanzo's father gives him all these lectures about, you know, free and independent, you're a farmer, you don't, you know, you depend on you. And there's another whole...
That's right.
That was a huge part of that whole book.
I hope I've contributed to scholarship a great deal with this book, but I think my analysis of Farmer Boy is one of the best things I've done with my book. Other scholars of the Laura Ingalls Wilder books will say that Farmer Boy's theme was all about food and domesticity and happy farm life, and I say it was all about the economics of farming. Those conversations repeat throughout the book, and at the end, Almanzo's offered a chance to not be a farmer and to learn how to make wagons, and he doesn't do it. And that whole free and independent phrase that repeats itself throughout the books shows up for the first time in Farmer Boy.
Yeah, and Rose, she wrote her own fiction as well. And one of the books she wrote, and I think that her books were, the first came out in serials, I believe in magazines, but the one book that I've yes. read is Free Land.
Free Land was written for adults, but it was the same kind of thing. It was people were going to break their backs for that free land. It wasn't being handed to them by the government at all. They were earning it with every hard thing they did, you know, and the emphasis on the homesteader as hero.
She was very adept at getting this message into her writing and the writing that she did with her mother. As time went on, though, they finished writing those books and Rose moved on. Was she more involved in a kind of a more solid way in the whole libertarian movement?
Oh, yes. The last Little House book came out in 1943. And after that, all of Rose's writing was about political themes and economics. She was purely a nonfiction writer at that point. That's also the same year her magnum opus that she called The Discovery of Freedom came out with a very limited print run. The book got almost no notice. She was horribly disappointed in that. But to libertarians, that book was key to getting the libertarian movement and eventually the Libertarian Party, which didn't call itself that till later, but going because of her writing and thinking and that book, The Discovery of Freedom.
And didn't she leave her estate and the handling of her estate to, is it Roger McBride?
Rose befriended, kind of took under her wing, at the time he was still a teenager, Roger Lee McBride, whose father was Rose's Reader's Digest editor. Reader's Digest condensed one of Rose's earlier books during the 1940s, a book called Let the Hurricane Roar. And she got to know Roger when he was in school. They started writing to each other. He learned all about free market principles from her. He called her grandma. And eventually he was named her lawyer and agent and her heir. Rose had no surviving children. Her only child had died at birth many, many years before. And Roger was a card-carrying Libertarian Party member when the party first formed, and he ran for president as a Libertarian in 1976. He definitely was carrying the torch for these ideas. The other thing I should mention is that around the time that Roger was kind of coming of age and getting involved in politics himself, Rose donated a key amount of money to a school that was being formed out in Colorado called the Freedom School. It was later known as Ramparts College, a man named Robert Lefevre. And that school would have adults come for 2 weeks at a time and do these intense training sessions on free market principles and how to limit the size of government. And guess who two of the early students were? Well, David and Charles Koch, the Koch brothers, who would ever after say that those early libertarian ideas were a foundation of their political thinking.
A lot of the books were about, you know, making a living off the land, men making a living off the land and doing the right thing for their family. But the people that really saved that family, women who were not making a living off the land, but they were writing. And
yes, farming for the wilders was not a success until Laura began writing about it. And then she did become financially secure with the books. Until that happened, she and Almanzo were getting by, but they were barely getting by.
That was Christine Woodside, author of Libertarians on the Prairie, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and The Making of the Little House Books. That's it for today's edition of The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we're going to go to Freakonomics. This is Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3, KOJI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College. It's 89 degrees in Sioux City. It's 84 degrees at the Iowa Great Lakes at 1 o'clock.